This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. I hope the new year has gotten off to a good start for you. Most people want to live a long life, but one of the things that terrifies people about growing old or about their parents or grandparents growing old is Alzheimer's disease. We're going to discuss what we know about how the disease attacks the brain and destroys memory, and what researchers are investigating that might delay its onset and reduce the damage it causes. My guest is British neuroscientist Joseph Gibelli, author of the new book, In Pursuit of Memory, The Fight Against Alzheimer's. The subject is personal for him because when he was 12, his grandfather developed Alzheimer's. He died 7 years later. Gibelli's book is based in part on his travels around the world, talking with scientists conducting Alzheimer's research. Joseph Gibelli, welcome to Fresh Air. Is there a genetic test that is truly a predictor of whether you will get Alzheimer's?
So there is for a very small group of Alzheimer's patients. About 5 to 10% of Alzheimer's patients have what we call early onset Alzheimer's disease. And these are patients who can develop it in their 50s, 40s, and even 30s. And for them, many of them have inherited a genetic mutation, which gives them a 50-50 chance of developing the disorder. And so some patients will have a genetic mutation that if they carry that particular genetic mutation, they will certainly go on to develop Alzheimer's. And there is a test for those individuals. And in the book, I interviewed many of the patients with early onset Alzheimer's disease, and some of the patients decided to have the test and found out they were positive. And it sort of changed their life in many different ways. And other patients decided they didn't want to know. But for the vast majority of Alzheimer's cases, what we call the late onset Alzheimer's cases, the story is a little bit different. It's more that there are, as opposed to genetic mutations, there are what we call genetic risk factors. And these are just variants in DNA, just in the same way that you have variants in DNA that account for differences in eye color, height, hair, all these things that differentiate us from one another. There are lots of the risk factors for Alzheimer's, and we've identified about 20 so far, and we know that they just slightly tip the scale in favor of Alzheimer's. But there is one in particular, a risk factor called APOE4, and we know that that is a particularly strong risk factor for Alzheimer's. We know, for instance, that the APOE4 gene is present in about 30% of the population, but it's also present in about 50% of all Alzheimer's cases. So you could, if you wanted to, there are all these companies these days who allow you to have your genome sequenced, or you can be tested for certain genes. You can find out, for instance, if you carry the APOE4 gene. But as I said earlier, I don't think I would want to know that information, because having the APOE4 gene certainly doesn't mean you're definitely going on to get Alzheimer's disease. It just means you have a higher risk, but it's relative risk. It's not absolute risk. So it all depends on what your baseline risk is, and we don't know what that is. So there are tests for you to understand your risk, but there's not, for the vast majority of cases, there's not a test to know definitively if you're destined for Alzheimer's.
There's several memory tests on the market. Can I tell you that you're having a memory decline because of Alzheimer's?
It's very difficult to glean meaningful information from memory tests, because memory works in very many ways to a muscle. And often people have everyday forgetting simply because they're a bit tired, they might be a bit depressed, they haven't maybe given enough attention to the thing they're trying to remember in the first place. So there are all these different factors that can affect your memory. And when you go through the process of getting a diagnosis for Alzheimer's, so I did this in the book, for one of my chapters, I actually went through the process of having the cognitive tests and having the memory tests and speaking to the memory specialists and going through every step along the way of someone who goes on to learn if they have Alzheimer's or not. And all the memory tests do is just, they add to a collection of evidence that then allows clinicians to say, there's a diagnosis of probable Alzheimer's disease, is what they call it. We can only tell definitively at post-mortem when pathologists then look in the brain and they see the buildup of these sticky proteins that we call plaques and tangles, and they look at that, and that, in collaboration with the deficits in memory and the behavioral changes and all of the sort of clinical signs that you see in a patient during life, that is all put together to then to tell the neurologist, okay, this person had Alzheimer's disease. So the memory tests are only a small piece of the puzzle. And, you know, it's very interesting because recent research has actually suggested that although memory is one of the first things to go in Alzheimer's disease, there are other things that are actually maybe just as important. So we know, for instance, that navigation is a very early telltale sign of Alzheimer's disease, navigation loss, rather, I should say, and that getting lost and wandering around. And this was certainly true for my grandfather. But I think before he actually forgot me and my sister and the rest of my family, he would often just wander out of our house and wander away from the dinner table. And my father would have to go out into the neighborhood and find him. And so there are memory tests, and there are lots, as you say, advertised online. And I think it's good for people to do these sort of tests and to train their memory, because you can train memory, you can do things to improve your memory. And so I think I would encourage people to do that. But in terms of whether or not that's a sign of Alzheimer's, I would be very cautious about that, because it's just, as I said, a small piece of the puzzle as to what Alzheimer's is.
There's also a lot of products on the market that claim to be able to strengthen your memory through various exercises and games. What's the research on that? How effective are those things? Do you have any idea?
Yeah, so I wrote about brain training in the book. I have a chapter where I traveled to Japan to meet Ryuta Kawashima. I don't know if you remember Ryuta Kawashima. He's the Japanese neuroscientist that pioneered the Nintendo brain training games that sort of created quite a stir for a long time, and he's still working on them now. The evidence for these memory games and these brain training games is very conflicting. There is some evidence for it, but the problem is the trials are not big enough, they're not sophisticated enough, and they haven't been replicated enough for us to say definitively, if you engage in this memory game, you will significantly increase your memory. And lots of researchers think that actually, you're just training certain parts of the brain, and you're getting good at the game itself, as opposed to increasing the capacity and the ability of your memory in a global sense. And so it's an ongoing area of research. It's something that there is evidence for. And again, I would certainly still encourage people to do these things, because training your brain and remaining mentally engaged and active in as many ways as you can is good for the brain. But we still don't know for sure whether or not these are having a significant effect.
Everybody who reaches a certain age and starts losing some of their memory thinks like, oh my God, am I getting Alzheimer's? And what everybody always says is, if you lose your keys, you're just being forgetful. If you forget what your keys are for, then you're starting to have dementia. Is that a helpful way of looking at it?
I think that's a very helpful way of looking at it, because it helps to distinguish between just normal everyday forgetting and something that is potentially a bit more sinister. So as you said, losing your keys, forgetting where you put your glasses is completely normal. But when you find your glasses and your keys and you think, what are these for? That's a sign that there's something else going on, that it's not just the memory loss. Because we know, for instance, that healthy brains shrink and lighten by about 10% between the ages of 50 and 80. And it used to be thought that the reason they shrink and lighten by that degree is because you lose loads of brain cells. But actually, you don't. Actually, you keep a lot of the brain cells that you have throughout your life. It's just that the brain cells shrivel up, they get a bit smaller, the contacts between each brain cell reduce in number, and so they just function a bit more slowly. And that's why, as you get older, you do have problems with just day-to-day tasks and everyday remembering. But, suddenly not being able to understand what keys are for and what glasses are for is a sign that there's a deep underlying confusion that's setting in. And it's when you have that confusion that is a sign that it's something a bit more malign than just normal everyday forgetting. So I think that is a good way of describing the difference.
So what are typically the first symptoms of Alzheimer's?
The first symptoms of Alzheimer's are usually mild forgetting, confusion with day-to-day tasks, things like paying the bills, stocking the fridge, and a sort of mild confusion. So they're quite subtle, They're the sort of things that people do experience at just a normal, healthy aging, and they're quite difficult to detect. And that's actually been a big problem in the field, because You know, lots of the old drug trials have failed because we think that actually many of the people in the drug trials didn't have Alzheimer's disease. They just had sort of a normal, healthy forgetting. So the early signs are quite mild. It's when it then goes on to the sort of the moderate to the late stage symptoms that you really start to see the true face and character of Alzheimer's disease.
And you said that when a person gets Alzheimer's, the brain is actually under attack. Mm. Can you describe the attack?
Yes. So in Alzheimer's disease, there is a huge buildup of these sticky clumps of proteins that we call plaques and tangles. And in an Alzheimer's patient's brain, the brain is literally littered with plaques and tangles. And we know that plaques and tangles are toxic to brain cells. Some people refer to them as killer proteins. And so we still don't understand exactly how these plaques and tangles lead to cell death in the brain. But we know that the brain is essentially under attack by the presence of these toxic proteins. And we know that also once Alzheimer's starts, the immune system kicks in. And when the immune system kicks in, you get a sort of runaway inflammation, which actually makes the whole process much worse in many ways. And so, you know, the brain cells are sort of struggling to stay alive. The immune system to begin with, we think, tries to heal the brain, tries to remedy the situation and clear away the plaques and tangles, but for whatever reason it seems to fail. So it very much can be seen as an attack in the sense that there are these bizarre buildup of these strange proteins that seem to be damaging brain cells in a massive degree.
Is there a part of the brain that's typically attacked first?
Yeah, so the hippocampus is the brain region that is typically attacked first. And the hippocampus is a region deep within the brain, and it controls the conversion of short-term memories to long-term memories. It's very important for the formation of new memories. It doesn't store memory. Well, we don't think it stores memory. Memory itself, we think, is stored in the cortex, sort of the outer layers of the brain. But the hippocampus is a very important way station for memory. And the plaques and tangles seem to build up to quite a striking degree in the hippocampus. And then as the disease progresses, they slowly fan out to the rest of the brain.
So does that explain why short-term memory is the first to go with Alzheimer's and why people with Alzheimer's often seem to be living in the past, thinking that their children, who are now adults, are actually still little children, thinking that they live in a home that they used to live in as opposed to where they currently live?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So because the hippocampus does have such a crucial role in short-term memory, and it's because it's one of the first things to go, short-term memory is affected at the beginning of the disease. And, you know, as the disease progresses, you do, when you meet these patients, they are very much, as you said, sort of living in the past. And in the book, I described it as watching someone endlessly fall back through time. With my grandfather, it was certainly the case. He was confusing his wife for his second wife for his first wife, for instance, and very much sort of being slightly aware of things in his distant past. You could show him photographs of when he was very young, and you would see some flicker of recognition. But the immediate past, the short term memory was gone quite quickly.
If you damage your skin will probably heal. When the neurons get damaged in the brain, they don't heal, right? Correct me if I'm wrong there.
Yeah, that's right. So in the central nervous system, the neurons don't appear to regenerate. They're what we call post-mitotic. So, you know, once you have those neurons for the rest of your life. However, there is a lot of really exciting research coming out now into neural stem cells that suggests that actually there are populations of cells in the brain that may provide regeneration, that may actually give birth to new neurons in the brain. And some scientists think that if we can figure out where these populations of neural stem cells are, and if we can figure out what the biochemical and genetic messages are that activate these cells, that, you know, we can develop a drug to switch those on, essentially, to allow the brain to heal itself. So, you know, it's a very exciting field at the moment because a lot is happening. A lot of things that we thought in the past, like like neurons just sort of having them for the rest of your life. Those concepts are being challenged now.
So how far along is that research?
It depends who you ask. I suppose I would say it's still very much in its infancy. We're still trying to figure out, you know, what these brain stem cells are and how they operate. It's still in its infancy, but at the same time, I would say, you know, it's important to remember that science doesn't operate in a linear fashion. Sometimes there are just these great breakthroughs, these great eureka moments that can just change the game entirely. So I'm always optimistic that, whatever early stages the research is in, I'm always optimistic that there'll be a eureka moment just around the corner.
So you mentioned earlier that there's a gene that in some cases seems to be, you know, to correlate with Alzheimer's. It's not a 100% predictor, but it can help predict if you're going to develop Alzheimer's in the future. Is that being addressed through genetic medicine?
Yes, it is, absolutely. So the gene APOE4 does significantly increase one's risk. If you carry two copies of the APOE4 gene, you have a significantly higher risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. And so now geneticists and neuroscientists are trying to figure out a way of either silencing that gene using genetic methods, or actually changing the gene entirely. There's this revolutionary new genome editing tool called CRISPR that lots of scientists are working on now. And, you know, what would be really great is if we could use something like CRISPR to sort of cut out the APOE4 gene and instead put an APOE2 gene. So that's just a different version of this gene. But the APOE2 gene actually seems to protect someone from Alzheimer's disease. It lowers the risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. So, you know, in conjunction with these drug trials targeting the plaques and tangles using antibodies and the immune system, there are lots of geneticists that are saying, hang on, this has probably got much deeper genetic roots, and let's see what we can do with the underlying genes to treat the disease.
So we've talked about research that's in the works. Some researchers say, well, lifestyle is an issue too, things like stress, sleep, diet, exercise. Is there any really hard evidence that any of those factors would have an influence on either the development or, you know, the speed of developing Alzheimer's?
So I wouldn't say there's hard evidence. There is certainly evidence, and the evidence is growing rather than fading. The studies that look at lifestyle factors at the moment just aren't big enough. They're done on sort of hundreds or thousands of people over quite a short period of time. But to really know definitively whether certain lifestyle factors have a significant impact on Alzheimer's, you need to look at, you know, much larger populations of people over much longer stretches of time. And just logistically, that's a very hard thing to do. But as I said, the evidence is growing. So we know, for instance, that anything that's good for the heart is good for the brain. Post-mortem studies have shown that
wait,
in 80%...
Why do we know that? What's the correlation?
So we know that from post-mortem studies, 80% of people with Alzheimer's disease have some form of cardiovascular disease as well. So there does seem to be some link between the you know, having a healthy heart and having a healthy brain. And having a healthy blood supply as well seems to do wonderful things for the brain. But in terms of understanding exactly what's going on to reduce your risk of Alzheimer's, we know, for instance, that when you exercise, your brain releases this molecule we call BDNF, which just stands for brain-derived neurotrophic factor. And we know that BDNF acts as a sort of fertilizer for the brain and can lead to the growth of new neurons and new synapses. Some studies have shown that having a Mediterranean diet seems to lower the risk of Alzheimer's. And there's a lot of really exciting research going on into turmeric at the moment, because we know that there's
this
a compound
within the spice turmeric.
Yeah, the spice turmeric, the Indian spice turmeric. There's a compound within turmeric called curcumin, and curcumin seems to actually dismantle plaques and tangles, and you can see this happening beneath the microscope. And so, as I said, it's sort of fragmentary evidence, but it is accruing, and it is getting more convincing. We know that sleep has hugely beneficial effects for the brain. When you sleep, your brain essentially cleans itself. It uses cerebral spinal fluid to pump away the plaques and tangles that we think cause the disease. And so lots of researchers now are looking into ways of using sleep to treat Alzheimer's disease and seeing if a certain level of sleep can somehow affect the symptoms or somehow slow the disease down. And so, you know, there is evidence for lifestyle factors. And, you know, most neuroscientists you speak to will be cautiously optimistic about it. Because as I said, you know, the evidence isn't conclusive yet, but, it is building.
You say that for now, the hope is to reach where we are currently with diabetes. What's the comparison?
Mm-hmm. So, because, you know, not so long ago, diabetes was very much a death sentence, but now there are medications that can control it in a very effective way. And so I think it's the same, it's very similar for Alzheimer's in the sense that the cure for Alzheimer's isn't actually what most people think. The cure for Alzheimer's will probably be something that manages it, that controls it, or rather that pushes it back. Because we know that, for instance, if you can push this Alzheimer's disease back by 1 year, there would be 9 million fewer cases of the disease. If you could push it back by 5 years, it would effectively half the globe's number of Alzheimer's patients.
Wait, why is that? Because people would die of other causes before getting
exactly.
Alzheimer's?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because they would die of other causes before getting Alzheimer's. So, you know, once you pass the age of 65, every 5 years, your odds of Alzheimer's double. But, you know, obviously it depends what your baseline odds are. But, you know, because it's primarily a disease of old age, if we can just push it back or manage the symptoms to the point where they don't have the profound memory loss, they don't have the confusion and the fear and all of the things that come along with Alzheimer's disease, you can push that back and just let them, and then they will die naturally of some other process. So it's not, you know, it's similar to diabetes in the sense that, you know, it's finding a way to manage it and to treat it and to try and keep the symptoms of it at bay.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Joseph Giubbelli is the author of the new book, In Pursuit of Memory, The Fight Against Alzheimer's. Curtis Harding is an Atlanta-based singer and songwriter who got his start as a backup singer with CeeLo Green. His new album, called Face Your Fear, was co-produced by Danger Mouse, who's made hits with Green, The Black Keys, and Adele. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
Tight and precise, Curtis Harding nails down every syllable he articulates on Need Your Love, a crisp bit of soul shouting on his new album, Face Your Fear. Now in his late 30s, Harding seems to possess a deep knowledge of the past half century of rhythm and blues. Working with co-producers Danger Mouse and Sam Cohen, Harding makes it sound easy to toss off an impeccable piece of Motown pop like On and On. Harding did was emulate his elders, he'd be a solid musical impersonator. But he's more than that. Listen to the ambitious piece of music that leads off his album, a composition called Wednesday Morning Atonement. Sung in the voice of a wandering father trying to explain a long absence from his children, the melody is sorrowful and deliberate. Harding's singing is so direct, it refuses any excuses or self-pity. It's the sound of a man accepting the blame and reproach he deserves. Hello, children. Well, it's been such a very long time. I finally found the mind to explain where I've been living. Curtis Harding most often curls his voice upward into a blue falsetto. It is inevitably reminiscent of another Curtis, Curtis Mayfield. Harding uses that voice with a cold firmness on the album's title song, Face Your Fear.
You can scream if you want to, baby, but no one can hear. You can fight through the night, but by daylight you disappear. If there's a way,
for a singer who's so attuned to the sounds and styles of old pop music, you'd think Harding would be best served by quick songs with concentrated little verse, chorus, verse structures. But that's not always the case here. He achieves some of his best effects when a melody unfurls at a more leisurely pace, when his melancholy has the opportunity to explain itself at length. That's true of Wednesday Morning Atonement, which I played earlier, and it's very true of a languid ballad that arrives late in this album called Ghost of You.
There was a time when I could touch you, baby.
Curtis Harding makes music whose originality emerges from the contrasting pop genres being blended. Lyrics are less important than the stories told by his shifts in tone and emphasis. There's a searching earnestness throughout Face Your Fear that denies all irony or artifice. It suggests that for Harding, facing fear involves doing his best to sound as though he's dropping his guard and letting you in.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Yahoo TV. He reviewed Curtis Harding's new album, Face Your Fear. In an era when kids look forward to the Sunday newspaper comics, my guest Cullen Murphy lived in the world where those comics were created. His father, John Cullen Murphy, drew a comic about a prize fighter called Big Ben Bolt. In 1970, he started drawing the popular comic strip Prince Valiant, about a Norse prince in the King Arthur era. Prince Valiant was created in 1937 by Hal Foster, who asked Cullen's father to do the illustrations after Foster's arthritis got bad. In 1980, Foster handed over the writing to Cullen. Cullen wrote Prince Valiant while his father continued to draw it for the next 24 years until his father's death. Cullen Murphy's new memoir, Cartoon County, is about his father and the surprising number of other cartoonists who lived near or in Fairfield County, Connecticut, where Cullen grew up in the 1950s and 60s. They included the artists and or writers behind Popeye, Little Orphan Annie, Blondie, Hagar the Horrible, and Nancy. In addition to writing Prince Valiant, Cullen Murphy was the managing editor of The Atlantic magazine for 20 years and has been an editor-at-large at Vanity Fair since 2006. Cullen Murphy, welcome back to Fresh Air. Describe what the Sunday comics were like when you were growing up surrounded by the guys who did the comics.
Well, they were glorious. So imagine a Sunday morning when 16 full pages of comics arrives with the newspaper. And the comics are so important that they wrap the newspaper. It's not like the front page of the Daily News or, you know, the Journal American with all the important headlines are wrapping the comics. It's the other way around. And these pages are the size of a newspaper broadsheet. And the color is beautiful. And this has been going on for decades, really since the turn of the century. And the pages were so big that for a kid, you could not realistically sit in a chair and read the comics. You had to spread them out across the floor, just like almost your comic strip image of a kid reading the comics. But it's hard to recapture what a big deal newspaper comics were for a long part of our history, and particularly at the very heart of the American century.
So I'm going to ask you to describe Prince Valiant, the comic strip that your father drew for decades and that you wrote for 24 years until your father died in 2004. Describe what the strip was about.
Prince Valiant was the son of a royal family of Thule in what is now Scandinavia. And when the
strip
began...
Is Thule made up or is that a real place?
Well, it's a real place in the context of the comics, which for me is real enough.
Okay.
But I think it's... I think it's made up. There is a place called Thule, but Hal Foster's Thule was a made-up place.
Okay.
And Prince Valiant's royal family was a made-up royal family. But guess, aren't they all? And Val, when the strip opens, is a young kid. He's escaped from political trauma in his homeland, and he arrives in King Arthur's Britain. And through a series of adventures, he's eventually... knighted. He becomes a Knight of the Round Table. He marries Alita, Queen of the Misty Isles. They have twins and a couple of sons, and the adventures take him all over the world. They take Alita all over the world, and they take the children all over the world. I think by the time I stopped doing the strip, members of the family had been to every continent except Antarctica.
Wow. Okay. And it's written in this kind of like old medieval or dark ages kind of language. I mean, not the language that they really would have spoken, but our idea of what it might have sounded like. Can you read one of the captions for us to give us a taste of the language? And maybe you could read one that you wrote.
Sure. I'll give you one here in a second. But your description is right. It's kind of a modern person's idea of what older English was like, filtered through Walter Scott and then refiltered through me and my dad and Hal Foster. And here's the opening sequence of a particular episode. The picture in the background shows King Arthur's palace in ruins after a horrific battle. Camelot. The refugees who stream from Britain tell tales of horror and woe. The city of Marvel, once a golden jewel amid emerald fields, stands bent and tarnished, a forbidding fortress. The meadowlands are sear with drought. Where jousts took place, gallows sprout. It has been a year since Mordred seized the throne, and the common folk of Britain have learned how long a year can be.
It's kind of Shakespearean to end the first part with a rhyme, no?
I was thinking Jesse Jackson, but I'll take Shakespeare.
So one of the things your father used to do was pose for himself, taking Polaroid pictures of himself so he could use himself as a model. And you often were the person snapping the photos. Would you describe some of the ways that he posed and some of the things he wore while he posed?
I have thousands of these pictures. My father really never threw anything away. And something like the pictures that he took of himself, he always, I'm sure in the back of his mind thought, oh, I can use one of these pictures again, but he never did. He just kept taking more pictures. Bear in mind that in a typical Prince Valiant strip, there might be, 20 human figures on a given Sunday, and they're all doing different things. And like other cartoonists, he knew enough anatomy, he had classical training, he could draw these from scratch, but it was a lot easier, and it would help with things like shadows and drama if he could have something to work with. So he would dress himself up in different costumes and take pictures of himself and adjust the lighting. And it would be things like, he would dress himself as a monk. He would dress himself as a knight. He would dress himself as a woman and put a wig on and a dress. He would lie on his back with his feet and his arms in the air as if he'd just been run through with a sword or fallen off a horse during a joust. He would have these expressions of, horrific anger or, ridiculous, preposterous laughter. And I have a collection of these that runs really from 1950, when he was doing a different strip, all the way up until shortly before his death. And it's the most remarkable and bizarre collection of family portraits that you can imagine having, and wonderful to look at.
So when your father was drawing, especially true earlier in his career, when he was drawing Sunday comics, there are a lot of things you weren't allowed to show anatomically. What were some of those things?
Well, Ernie Bushmiller, who did Nancy, at one point in his life was working in what was called the bullpen at one of the syndicates. The bullpen were the people who received the strips, the original strips, when they were sent in by cartoonists and then prepared them for publication. And they were the line of first resort when it came to, I guess you'd have to call it, censorship. And he had a list of what he called 35 no's, the things you couldn't show. And, some of them would be obvious, and some of them were not obvious, like you weren't allowed to show a pair of dirty socks lying on a chair. I have no idea why that was a rule. It was a rule, and you had to live by it. But one of the things that was, a source of bedevilment, not just for my father, but for others, was navels. You couldn't show navels on people, and you couldn't show nipples on men.
Well, let me stop you there. You have a drawing that your father did from when he was drawing a comic strip about a prize fighter called Big Ben Bolt. And so, of course, he's bare-chested, he's in the ring, and he has no nipples.
That's right. If you can't use nipples on men, you're going to have something lacking when you depict prize fighters, or in strips like Alley Oop, or in BC, any place where you have bare-chested men. And navels is a problem, too. Now, Mort Walker tried to fight back against the naval ban. And there was a character, Ms. Buxley, who was often shown wearing a bikini. And Mort would just routinely draw a navel on Ms. Buxley. And the boys in the bullpen would get the strip. They'd see it was from Mort. They would see that Ms. Buxley was in it. And they would take an X-Acto knife and take the navel out. And then after a while, they began sending navels back to Mort, the ones that they had taken off, just as their way of fighting. And then Mort, when he would do his strip, would start putting in more navels than you can imagine. He would put in a crate of navel oranges just so he could put navels in. And they would send them all back, and he had something, at least he claimed he had something called Beetle Bailey's belly button box.
The curious thing is that, men were already on beaches with bathing trunks and no top. It's not like this was something that children hadn't seen. Like, you can't let a child see a male's nipples. Or you can't let a child see a belly. Like, children are always so curious about whether you have an innie or an outie. And so why were these prohibitions existing? What were they about?
Well, I think you have to go back and look at the structure of the industry just more broadly. This is a mass medium in publications with largely conservative owners, and things that are being printed have to conform to, standards is probably the wrong word, but the wishes of a certain large proportion of the readership. It's an issue that affects any kind of mass medium. And so, comic strips were subject to that. And as a result, lots of things would creep in that otherwise would be accepted by almost everybody as normal. For instance, smoking a pipe. Because tobacco was frowned on in some areas, smoking a pipe in some places could be really a problem. And pipes would be whited out of a strip. So you'd have some guy with his hand up to his mouth as if he's holding something, but there's nothing there.
That's very strange. You were very close with your father, and for 24 years you wrote Prince Valiant as your father drew it. And his signature was John Cullen Murphy. You're Cullen Murphy, so you shared a name. I'm wondering if you ever experienced a need to pull away, and I ask this because you were born in 1952, so you came of age in the late 60s and early 70s at a time of basically generational warfare, when kids were really, a lot of kids were really rebelling against their parents and disagreeing about the war, disagreeing often about civil rights and about gay rights and women's rights and clothing and haircuts and what a good life meant, what to eat. I mean, basically everything. So did you ever experience any of that?
I think everyone in the family went through something along those lines. But it never became too serious a problem in our family for a very specific reason, I think. One of the characteristics of cartooning families was that the cartoonist had somehow figured out how to live his life on his own terms. It wasn't following a path that somebody had laid out, whether it's, going to graduate school or, following the footsteps into the contracting business or whatever. These people had some sort of a vision of what they wanted to do. It took a lot of ingenuity and creativity to cobble the right ingredients together, and they had all somehow managed to do it. And this sense of your life and your lifestyle being something that you can create for yourself and that you have a right to create for yourself was a value that I saw in other families, and that certainly was a core value in my own family. So that when those of us in the family wanted to pursue this, that, or the other thing, the important question from my parents was, what is it that drives you? Pay attention to that. And I think that that attitude has a way of minimizing certain kinds of frictions that might otherwise be there.
Hmm. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So in the final days when you were writing Prince Valiant and your father was drawing it, that whole world was dying. The Sunday comics no longer meant what they used to. And Prince Valiant, which is still being published today, but it didn't have, I don't think it had the kind of audience by then. But you have a quote in here about that world dying that I'd like you to read for us.
It's from a conversation with Dick Brown, who drew High and Lois and created Hagar the Horrible. And I'd gone to visit him and his wife at their home. We were just talking about the world of cartoonists in Fairfield County that we had all known. You could feel that it was beginning to dissipate. People were moving. Older cartoonists were dying. This very special place in two decades was not going to be what it was like. And I asked him about that. And he said, I feel right now the way I used to feel as a kid when the movie was over. The credits would start to roll. The lights would start to come up. And I would walk slowly backwards up the slanting aisle, watching the screen, just trying to make it last as long as I could.
It's really a beautiful quote about how wonderful movies and parts of life are. So I have another Prince Valiant question for you. I don't know if you watch Game of Thrones.
I've actually read Game of Thrones.
Oh, okay. Do you think that Game of Thrones is in any way kind of satisfying some of the same needs as Prince Valiant used to, but in a much more sexually, in a much more explicit way in terms of sex and violence?
Well, it absolutely is. I remember when I first picked up the George Martin books, it was not my idea to do it. It was my children were saying, you've got to read these. So for Christmas, I think I got the first three of them, and I started in and couldn't put them down. I thought they were extremely well done, and I was captivated. I actually had to just stop, because otherwise the rest of my life would have been taken over by just reading Game of Thrones. But I think that Game of Thrones has many of the same elements that appealed to people about Prince Valiant, although in a much more aggressive and, you know, sometimes prurient way. The one thing that Prince Valiant didn't do that Game of Thrones does all the time is kill off its leading characters.
Colin Murphy, thank you so much for talking with us.
Terry, thank you. It's been great.
Colin Murphy's new memoir is called Cartoon County.